This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Zaha Hadid was one of a handful of architectural rock stars who reshaped our understanding of what a building could be, taking full advantage of computer-assisted design and engineering to create buildings that sweep and flow like they're not made of solid matter. Her most famous buildings include the London Olympic Aquatic Center and the Guangzhou Opera House. She worked all over the world. There's a huge cultural complex in Baku, Azerbaijan, that opened recently, and her World Cup stadium in Qatar is under construction. Hadid was the first woman ever to receive the Pritzker Prize, the most prestigious award given to an architect. She was born in Iraq and based in London. Her fatal heart attack in March came as a shock to the architectural world. A few months prior to that, staff writer John Seabrook sat down with Hadid at the New Yorker Festival to discuss her life and her work.
Hi, I'm John Seabrook, staff writer of the New Yorker. Welcome to the festival. So Zaha and I know each other from 2009 when I wrote a profile of Zaha in the New Yorker, and since then, some amazing projects opened. I want to talk about the one in Azerbaijan.
What is interesting about it is three buildings morphed into one. I mean, it's a theater, a museum, and a library. And the landscape, they are all continuous surface. They all kind of fall into one. And the lobby, the area which is public, part of the public domain, is for all of these entities. So the Azerbaijan project is made of fiber concrete. And what is interesting about this material is that you can have a completely kind of continuous surface, seamless surface. And the way it meets the ground, it looks like the same material, but it's not.
You really have to move through a Zaha building in order to really experience what it's like. And there was a piece written about the building in Azerbaijan, which I thought I'd just read a little bit from. Visitors find themselves in a curving wonderland that widens and narrows, rises and falls, pushing them along in a dynamic flow of converging and diverging walls and ceilings that transmit the dynamism of the shell to the interior. One aspect of your work which has been consistent is the idea of the inside and the way it's used and moved through informing the outside. So the inside almost becomes the outside.
We did all these studies of cities, and I think what happened, that kind of urbanism was sucked into the interior of these buildings. And then we started looking at the ground being the most important kind of public domain. That's why the exterior and the interior kind of flow into each other. And I think that also, we began to talk about liquid space, but at the time we talk about it, but we didn't really know how to achieve it. It took a long time to see how we can really convert this idea of kind of space and landscape or liquid space into an architecture.
Yeah, and again, landscape. Often her buildings, when you see them from afar, actually look like landscape.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people always say, oh, you know, you don't have a handrail. I say, when you go for a walk in the landscape, we don't have a handrail. People can still, you know, they don't mind. But this idea of the landscape, or let's say the fluid space, came out of looking at the time at certain developments, let's say, in the harbor. How you can replace these things, these kind of very large buildings, and connect the water back to the city through the idea of a land formation.
Yeah.
So the land formation led to when I became fluid space.
Let's jump back to Baghdad and your early years in Iraq. Now, you were born at a time when Baghdad was a very peaceful, cosmopolitan, dynamic place. Your father was a progressive politician, and there were a lot of people coming in and out of the house, talking, you recall, as a young person. What was the house like as a young person?
You know, I was very curious. My parents always, when I went, nagged them continuously, they did explain things to me. So I was very aware of politics, let's say, from maybe when I was 6, 7 years old.
Yeah.
So I understood that complexity of politics, and I was very lucky. We were affluent family, so we traveled a lot.
Yeah.
And we used to always go to Beirut. My other brother married a Lebanese, so that was like a second home. And, you know, back then it was very nice. You know, I went to a nun school.
Yeah, a convent.
Although I was a Muslim. You know, the nun school had girls of every kind, like Christian, Muslim, Jewish. And we all used to pray, till one day I discovered that I wasn't a Christian, that I shouldn't be crossing my heart. And I asked my parents, and my parents said, well, you don't have to, which was a very big mistake. They should not tell me this. Because I went back to the nuns and said, I don't have to cross my heart. So they then decided to exile the Muslim girls and the Jewish girls to the playground, which was for us was great, but they didn't tell us it's freezing cold in winter. Anyway, it was a very nice school, and it had a very interesting headmistress. She was a very tough nun, and she really believed in the education of women. So my life, I had a very nice life in Baghdad.
You had an asymmetrical mirror in your room.
Which I designed.
And when you were
I was into asymmetry when I was obviously a newborn. Well, also, again, you know, I wanted to design my own bedroom.
That's right.
Which I did.
You designed your own bedroom.
Yeah, and then everybody liked my bedroom. So everybody, the carpenter made it for everybody. So it was a mass-produced bedroom.
What was it like?
Well, it was kind of very 50s, 60s looking, you know, Italian wooden thing.
Sounds nice.
It was nice. I don't know whether it's still there, but...
What about the house? Do we know what's happened to the house?
The house was boarded. The only thing which was living in it was some very bright colored trees, but I think someone has obviously taken over and nothing has been looted. Because I found pictures of my childhood or letters I sent to my father on the internet.
So oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So I think it's been...
How did you find them on the internet?
Well, somebody called me and said, we have a letter which you must have sent to your father. And I thought, doesn't sound right. So I looked at the letter and I thought, this doesn't sound like me. And then someone else wrote it and said, no, actually, it sounds very much like you. You know, because it must have been all cheeky since you were a kid. And then suddenly certain photographs started appearing.
Well, that's sad.
Not when I was a baby, but, you know, in school and something like that. Mm. I know, it's a bit strange.
You haven't been back for a long time.
No, I haven't, no. And I would like to go back, actually.
Is it an ambition to one day build there?
I'm building the parliament. And the central bank.
And, what an amazing thing that would be, with your father and your
Yeah, race. Absolutely. I mean, my father was the head of the Iraqi Democratic Party, and that would be really great.
So some of your early drawings for projects essentially look like abstract paintings. I mean, you did paint, I think.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, so I think through the Malevich looking at that research and suprematism, one looked at abstraction.
Yeah.
And actually, the abstract drawings were really analysis of the site.
Yeah.
They were not like sort of just abstract for the sake of it.
Let's talk a little bit about how the computer came in during this period. In some ways, your designs anticipated computer-based design, but perhaps wouldn't have been possible to realize without the computer.
I think it would be, you can realize it, but I think not with the same precision.
Because I remember Patrick telling me before you had computer-based design, you would take drawings and put them on the Xerox, on the glass of the Xerox, and move so that it stretched the shape.
He is wrong, because that's when he started But he doesn't know what happened before he started. I mean, we were 20 or 10 of us there trying to do the most complex drawings. I think, stretching on the Xerox machine was one, but before that, it was all done by hand. You see, what was, I think, interesting is that all the research and drawing informed the work. And then, because it didn't just distort, it eventually made the work like that. Mm. So I might take a kind of a simple box, and through distortion or manipulation, but the work became like that.
Mm. Now, do you just work on the computer, begin work on the computer?
I don't. All the other
Do you still draw?
I draw, yeah. Well, they don't understand my drawings.
You do a lot of product design, sort of small things. And then you switch to very large buildings. Do they inform each other?
They can come from an idea of we've already done in architecture. They're kind of connected. Hmm.
Could shoes inform a building?
Yeah, but they're more like the architecture, the shoes. I mean, the Adidas thing was a different project.
Can we get those shoes now, the Adidas shoes? Are they?
I don't know. I couldn't get any. They were out of sold out.
They're sold out.
But I think you can get them, I'm sure.
Did you actually work with Pharrell Williams?
No, Pharrell just really called us and asked us to do this collaboration.
But he seems like a big fan of yours.
Well, that's nice, yeah.
I mean, maybe I'll write a
He's
song
a very nice guy, actually.
Do you have some dream projects that you're looking to the sky and praying?
My dream project is to go on a vacation.
When was your last
vacation? No, I really don't know. I think that, all these projects are rather, they all come with a different agenda. I mean, we've been very lucky. We've done, bridges, from large project to small project. So it's been very interesting.
Your own residence, as I recall, is not particularly highly designed. It's not a Zaha Hadid, really.
No, because nobody in my office will do it.
Well, maybe you don't want to live with your design when you
get... No, I don't mind living in my design. I think that it'd be nice to live in one's own thing. I think you can do that only when you are very young, when you don't mind waking up every day and seeing your mistake. Or you're quite old, where you're quite delirious and you don't notice it.
Well, that's a lovely note to finish on. Thank you very much, Zaha. And thank you, everybody.
Zaha Hadid, the late architect and designer of shoes, jewelry, objects, even the stage set for a Pet Shop Boys show in 1999. She was interviewed by New Yorker staff writer John Seabrook last fall.